You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today we return to the world of the vampire in the company of author Insha Fitzpatrick. With a growing reputation in the young adult field of literature, Insha has begun a new series focusing on the supernatural. The A Totally Factual Field Guide to the Supernatural series begins with Hanging with Vampires. We talk horror films and books, graphic novels, comics, Godzilla and vampires. And I know Insha's reputation will continue to grow through the quality of her work. Before that though, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as usual. Thank you to all my Patreon subscribers. Your assistance is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, information and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Store of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So we've got our stakes packed. We've garlic in our back pockets and holy water and sticky rice at the ready as we join Insha to go hanging with vampires. Many of us remember how we became interested in the supernatural and stories of monsters and myths. For some of us, it was a classic film rerun late-night television. Others stole secret time reading books for a little more mature reader. Or they were stories shared by family members on dark nights. In her new book, Hanging with Vampires, the first in the A Totally Factual Field Guide to the Supernatural, author Insha Fitzpatrick hopes to inspire and prepare the next generation to embrace the strange. Insha, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
I'm delighted. Your work is obviously primarily at the moment aimed at the young adult audience, and when I read the book I had to chuckle because I'm one of those people, Insha. I'm a real book hoarder. I have far more. I'm sure you might be the same, that I've got one of those piles of books to read that I keep adding to. I'm sure anybody is, and as also a lover of comics most of my life, because we'll say that comics helped me develop a love of reading when I was a small child. I used to dive into those kind of things. Do you think it's kind of interesting in regards to that kind of market that it seems to have really attracted a diverse and rich breadth of subject matter aimed at those particular people? Because like I say, when I read the book, it really made me laugh a lot. And whenever I'm in a charity shop, I will root about, and I'll always usually end up picking two or three books up. And I saw one very similar about a year ago, which was a monsters book, and I had to flick through it, and it was brilliant, and it was clearly aimed at children, but it was great. It had loads of monsters that you don't normally see in books for adults, so I thought, oh, I'll have that. And when I went to buy it, the gentleman said, you do know that's a children's book, sir? I said, yes. Yes, I do, thank you, there's my £3. So do you think that it's amazing how that people can sometimes look at this genre of fiction or books in general aimed at this particular market and not really appreciate just how good a lot of them are? Because this book's brilliant.
Thank you. I think so. The one thing that I remember as a really small kid is that, like, I wanted to read horror and I wanted to read science fiction and fantasy, but it wasn't like readily available to me. Like, we had the local library, obviously, but then you would have people who kind of, it was kind of like how you just mentioned the shop owner who was just like, you know, that's for like mature kids, and I'm like 5-6 years old, and like finally like able to kind of like read like small little sentences like Matilda, and I'm just like, I know, but the pictures are really cool, and I just really want to read about this world. Like, even if I have to have somebody read it to me, I just really want to read it. But it is like amazing now to like see how much the genre has grown inside of like middle grade and YA, and how much horror is actually like being embraced by like everybody. And especially when it comes to kids wanting to learn about monsters and anything like in the horror genre to begin with, it's still incredibly hard to convince people that like horror is worthwhile, and it's very hard to convince people that monsters are worthwhile. But like, it's also really important, and I think we've done it a lot in the book, where it's just like those stories, the monsters, the horror, they all connect to something that we all also know. It connects to history, it connects to science, it connects to anything, myths, lore. So it's really easy, I think, it's really easy to kind of push in the fact that you're going to be teaching kids about monsters, obviously, but then you're going to also be teaching kids about all of this rich history about this monster. That to me is what makes it, I think, a little bit more palatable to people. And especially because it's just like, oh, I don't want my child to be reading about monsters, but it's just like, but like the ooey gooey stuff is in there, but it's still so much fun, and you get to just like learn about like these cool creatures that like we all know about. It's not like we don't. Mm. But yeah, it's just it's incredibly hard, but at the same exact time, I think very much opening itself up.
I think you raise an interesting point there. As someone who would consider themselves a lover of horror, and I have been for most of my life as well, Insha, I still find it remarkable, even in this day and age, where we see films and books and miniseries that are smash hits all around the world, and yet there is still this artistic perception in some quarters that horror's worthless. It's a cheap thrill.
Yeah.
And I really sometimes find that baffling now. Maybe, you know, I can understand, you know, the horror film as we know it, or the sort of cultural embrace of the genres, probably you could probably say Nosferatu probably in the 1920s, so we're around 100 years into this.
Yes.
And we've had so many films over the years, and so many novels and shows that have really raised the bar, both artistically and frightening people out their seats all over. And yet some people are just so dismissive. As someone also that loves horror, Insha, do you think it's still amazing that there is this weird perception about horror films not having any real value?
I very much do. I find it kind of what's the word I'm looking for? It's not an insulting, but it's almost like it's like they're ashamed of horror in a weird way, where horror is the most to make at the box office. Horror is probably the most read genre. You could stick horror into anything that you do, like even animated films by this point. Mm. And I think it's very much still a genre that people are slightly like, not like, you know, people like us who like embrace it full on and just like, we are horror people. Like, it's just, it's never gonna change. But it's just like, I think that like the higher ups and like people who very much want to dismiss what horror has to offer doesn't really see its tremendous appeal to the way that our society just works now. And I think that people who are like higher up are very much scared of it, because it does reflect back in society. Horror is one of those like genres that in any sense of the word, it will reflect back at you. And it's one of those genres that if you are scared of something, you will, like, I remember as a kid, the first horror movie that I've ever watched, which everybody finds very funny, is The Exorcist of Rosemary's Baby.
Well, if you're going to start somewhere, you might as well start at the top, didn't you?
Right? And, like, I knew from a very young age, after watching Rosemary's Baby, that I didn't want anybody to touch me without my permission. And I also did not want to have a child.
Well, be careful of drinking cups of tea offered to you by nice old ladies as well.
It. And I didn't want to live in, like, brownstone apartments that look like those, like, high-rises that look like that. It's just, I knew it. I was just like, that's not my problem. That's not my business. You keep that over there. I'm going to stay here. But that's, like, that's a fear that has reflected back at me throughout the years. And I think horror, to a lot of people, they're just afraid of it because, like, it just reflects back fear, especially of how our society works now, especially in, like, America right now. It's easy to go. I think what's interesting about horror is that it's easy to go into a horror film, be scared, walk away. But then you also see, like, this tremendous amount of thinking that goes into horror that's very technical, very, what is the word that I'm looking for? Technical. It's like the writing is just tight. It's very much just a genre that, I know I said this like time and time again, but it reflects so much by doing so little, by being so big. And I think people are just afraid of that, and because of that, it just dismisses immediately in people's minds, because they're just like, oh, anybody can make a horror film. And it's just like, but you can't, though.
Yeah, well, there are numerous examples of people who can't, as we'll both be aware of. We take the very good with the very bad in this particular genre, and sometimes I love them both as much. So, I mean, what bit you then? What came first? Was it a love of the supernatural? Because I know you've got a big love for Greek mythology as well. So, what kind of got you first? Was it? I can't really say what got to me first, but I do remember being obsessed with the Universal monster films when I was like 5 or 6 years old, and being able to understand that they were films and I really loved them. And then sort of everything sort of from that point on led me into discovering the supernatural, and living in a haunted house helped as well. And having a grandma who was considered a very well-known psychic in the local field and things like that. So it was always, I suppose I was born into it, Insha. So I'm always interested to find out, especially when I speak to people from the States, what got you first, and were you corrupted by a family member who made you watch something you shouldn't have when they were babysitting you?
First of all, that's so cool about your grandmother and living in a haunted house. That's dope. I think, oh my God, it was two things. One, Universal Monsters immediately got me. My all-time favorite Universal monster is the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Because he's so wacky. He's so zany. I love him to bits, but I think his circumstances are probably, like, the not the coolest, but, like, because he is just the way that he is, that got me into knowing that there is this, like, wacky side of horror. And then watching Dracula and Frankenstein as a really young kid too had me go into, like, the serious side. Also the old Dark House, I believe it's called.
Yes, the Boris Karloff film.
Yes, that was another, like, film that, like, really got me into, like, that atmospheric haunted house horror. So that's one thing that got to me. And then on the other side, for the creature features, my dad is a really big Godzilla fan.
Oh.
So, like, my entire being when I was little up until right now has been like Godzilla movie. So it's like both of those things at one time really got me into like horror and creature features and kaiju and all of these monster movies. And then even with Godzilla, that made me like appreciate, and even Frankenstein, honestly, got me appreciating like monsters in general, and I wanted to know more, and I needed to find out more, and then I trickled down into like the actual monsters, the Godzillas and Mothras and Rodans, and then into like the human monsters of Norman Bates and Psycho, The Wizard of Gore, and all of those other things. It's just, it was just a trickle down effect.
Yes.
All these moments.
Yeah. Your father's clearly got a lot of taste, because I also adore Godzilla films, and I watched far too many as a child growing up. Strangely enough, I was having a conversation on one of the other shows I do, The Ghost Story Guys, and I was waxing lyrical about how much I love Destroy All Monsters.
Oh my god, so good!
Which is probably my favourite Godzilla film from that particular era. But like you say, there's loads when you talk about Rodan and Mothra.
my absolute all-time favourite has to be, this is on the wacky side of that entire thing, is Godzilla versus Ghidorah, the smog monster.
Oh, yeah.
So 70s, so crazy. Doesn't make a lick of sense, but I'm just like, go, Ghidorah, go.
Well, yeah, there's that one as well. Is that the one with the giant crab? Is the smog monster the one that's formed through pollution? It was like an environmental monster film. Is that?
Yes. It's exactly the one.
It's all the crap in the harbour that somehow comes alive.
Yeah. It's one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen. And I have like two or three different copies of it.
Mm.
mostly for the cover. Because I'm enthralled with that movie. And it's the only one that I think I remember it back and forth. Like the original Godzilla, I absolutely remember. But it's that one that is so, it's so 70s. It's so good. It's just like they have like this whole psychedelic scene that is out of place. It's just so wild.
Yeah, there are some very weird things. I'm trying to think which one it is. There's a Godzilla film, and I think, is it Ankylos, who's basically like that spiky club tailed friend of Godzilla's. And I think
I remember that.
and they go somewhere, and they start talking to each other. And I'm like, what? Even as a 9-year-old, I'm like, what's happening here? How long's Godzilla been able to talk? And he's like, come on, Tokyo's in trouble. And he's like, I'm swimming as fast as I can. And you're like, what on earth is happening here? What? This has nothing to do with the previous 14 films. And he never speaks again, as far as I know, Incha. I might have missed that. And I'm just like, what a weird thing to do in such a, you know, when you're like 15 films into a series, you suddenly make the main character talk. I mean, like, what?
It's also like when he's all of a sudden has a son, and yes. You're just like, okay, what happened here?
Yeah, son of Godzilla. Yeah, he was in a 3 or 4 of those, isn't he? Just running, just causing trouble and making Godzilla have to fight more, usually.
Right? It's just kind of like, why would Godzilla still be? I feel like after like the fourth film, it's just like, you're just calling me to call me now. You don't need me for anything. You're just pressing the button in the ocean and being like, Godzilla, I need you. Figure it out yourself.
Yeah. See, I even remember the cartoon. Like you say, they've got that guy with the button. Pew. There's trouble. Pew. And you're like, hang on a minute. How have they got a button to call Godzilla? What's going on here?
Right. So I feel like Godzilla by that point is so tired. It's just like, call back another day. Bye. Click.
Very much so. I, to be fair, after, I think, what, are we on now? 40-something films? I'd be tired as well, isn't she? Is that, you know, you're thinking, where are all these monsters coming from?
Right? And it's just like, man, just stop doing what you're doing.
Yes, everybody needs to calm down, I think.
Please.
So was it when you were getting into that kind of thing, like you say, I mean, I was very fortunate growing up. My parents were very open-minded, as you can probably tell. So we used to have a rule in our house that if I wanted to watch a certain horror film growing up, they would go to the local video store and they would rent it and they would watch it. And if they deemed it acceptable, it would always be on the mantelpiece on the morning, because I always used to watch them about 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I think what my parents were basically doing was getting drunk on a Saturday night and letting me watch horror films so they could deal with their hangovers and shit, which is
brilliant.
Yeah, probably not the best advice in the world of babysitting, but it worked for everybody concerned. Looking back, I think. And the only film as a sort of child, early teens, I was never allowed to watch was Halloween. So growing up in my mind, I don't think I actually watched it till I was about 17 or 18. And I think I built it up in my mind to be this like terrifying film. And when I watched it the very first time, I hated it, didn't like it. It's now one of my favourites and one of my favourite Carpenter films. I love John Carpenter films, especially that early period in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, because it was almost like he couldn't do any wrong for me. So did you ever get to that point, or were you able to sort of enjoy your love of films, or were you kind of having to wait till everybody had gone to bed and then just sneaking down and watching them?
So my parents were very open-minded. My mom less so, but my dad was kind of just like, yeah, I mean, whatever, watch what you want to watch. But the one, I almost had a similar experience to you, where it's just kind of like the one movie that not even my parents, but my aunt was like, I don't want you watching this, was Bram Stoker's Dracula by Francis Ford Coppola. Huh. I was around, I want to say like, 15, 16, I don't even know. And I saw it and I was just like, that doesn't look too bad. I mean, like, it was, and I specifically remember the cover because it was like that gray stone with that like one gargoyle head like on it. And I was just like, I don't know, man, that just looks so cool. I feel like I need to watch it because of the fact that the cover looks so cool. But before then, I was watching horror movies because I just wanted to. My parents really never policed me in order to do much of anything. Like, I watched like Halloween, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. The entire thing was like my favorite thing in the world when I was a kid. I had recently started getting into Herschel Gordon Lewis movies, which were like these like shoxploitation movies that he did. And my favorite by then was, I don't want to say Blood Feast, but it was like the Wizard of Gore. Mm-hmm. And I watched them, and those were worse.
Yes.
Than what I watched in Dracula. And so like when I saw Dracula, when I actually saw Dracula, I think when I was like 20, and then I had forgotten about it for so long. And then when I got into college and I decided that I wanted to study film, that was like my first go-to, because I was just like, oh, like I built this thing up so hard in my mind, the great stone thing, like cover with the gargoyle, and I really need to watch it because like it's just this childhood thing. And then when I saw it, I was kind of like you. I did not like it. And I was just like, wow, why did I waste my time on this? But then I, in revisiting it a couple of times, especially in regards to like vampires and how vampire media kind of like blew up over like the years that I had been studying film and also just like going about my horror business and by myself, I kind of was like, this is a really good movie. Technically, it's a really fascinating movie. Stylistically and aesthetically, beautiful shots, so beautiful. But yeah, I was kind of like, it was always kind of that thing. It was just like, do what you want. as long as you don't go out and stab someone, I guess, like, you're fine.
Yeah, well, yes. My parents had that kind of thing. As long as he's at home on a Saturday night watching horror films, it's fine. I'd rather he was doing that than running amok on the street somewhere, getting up to exactly. No good.
Exactly.
Give him like the evil dead. That'll keep him busy.
Right? I think my parents are always kind of just like, you know what? You could just keep watching horror films and, you know, if you want to sit down and watch this weird movie called Carnival of Souls, I'm not going to stop you. That's weird for me. Yeah. Go ahead, you. You got this, I think.
Well, even now, I think that's a bloody weird film. Myself, personally.
It's so weird.
I think I rewatched that last year. And I thought, bloody hell, what's going on here? It's like 60 years old, so God knows what people would have thought of that in the 1960s. Anyway, so obviously this has kind of carried on, and I know prior to launching this series, which we'll dive into the vampire first part of this exciting series that you're going to do. Obviously, prior to this, you've been co-writing with the marvelous Stephanie Cook and focusing on this rather unique scenario for the Oh My God series, which is another love of yours, which is Greek mythology. And so for me, I was very much the same. Once again, trying to keep children busy, my parents had a copy of the Iliad, which is not what you would expect to find in a mining village growing up. But my parents were very well read, so we had like the complete works of Dennis Wheatley and Dickens and all sorts, and you know, that kind of social improvement that comes through that kind of working class mentality in you. So I was very well versed with Greek myth growing up, because obviously I'd seen Jason and the Argonauts and loved it.
Oh, that movie's so good.
You know, and it follows on with my love of monsters and things, because obviously it's a Harryhausen classic. So for you, Greek mythology is one of those things that I'm amazed. Well, I'm not amazed, because they are phenomenal, that even something that is 2,000-3,000 years old, really, some of the birth of these of legends and stories and myths, that we still have such a connection with these wonderful stories, which you can see in all walks of life adapted and changed. And yes, the characters will be different and the scenarios will be different, but essentially most superhero and exciting adventures are all based, for me anyway, Incha, on the mythology that came out of the Greek and Roman eras, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very true. It's, oh man, like that was the thing I think that got us really wondering about, I don't want to speak for Stephanie, but I know that's like the one thing that really got us into wanting to create something with like Greek myths and everything like that, because like it's such a rich, what I don't think people really understand is that whole era filled with rich characters, rich stories, really great moral lessons, honestly, that I didn't really realize until much later in life. But like now that like I'm an adult and we got to actually make the book, we were kind of just like, I think what we can do is just make some really, really great characters and a story that just illuminates within like a space that like we would have loved as a kid. That's like the best thing about it. But like those stories back, like I remember the story of Pandora's Box when I was little,
mm-hmm.
and scared me. Scared me half to death. I was just like, I don't want to be her. That sucks. Like, if I had to unleash monsters on the world, I'd be hiding in my room for like years. No one would ever see me. And like to like, and to probably be like a 20, 30 something year old and like get with like Zeus. Never. Couldn't be me. Never.
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing that's always stayed with me from reading Greek myth. Man, that Zeus is a strange chap.
Yes. My guy, just calm down. And that was like one thing, like in Oh My Gods too, that we really wanted. We wanted to portray him like as like a good father, because we were just like, yo, my man is going wild. He can't do that in this life.
Yes.
Like, calm down.
Let's make him obsessed with sports instead. something a bit more wholesome.
Like, my guy liked pizza. I love that for him. But like, he's not out here like chasing women, thank God.
So I suppose as well, that's probably the biggest challenge when you're adapting such well-known and well-trodden characters into that, when you're trying to sort of repurpose them and reimagine them as young people, what you have to strip away from them, because obviously, you know, Zeus is a prime example of a very problematic hobby set, shall we say, but a lot of the others have some sort of challenges to go ahead. So I suppose that for me, when I look at that particular project that you've got going, mm-hmm. I suppose that the hardest part is to how much can you strip away without you lose the actual essence of who that character is.
Yeah, that was what's funny enough is that was, I think, my particular challenge with us creating Oh My Gods, because I, as Stephanie was kind of like, we both focused very much like on the overall story, but my favorite thing about creating like a fictional world is creating characters, and I wanted to create realistic characters that like you would want to be best friends with, I would want to be best friends with, or we would hate altogether, or we would just kind of be indifferent with, like, but I wanted to make these Greek gods just seem like cool people, you know, like, or just okay people, and not have them be what we automatically think of them as, but something that we very much can just see, look, and just look at and kind of like relate to them. Because how you said, one of the really big challenges for adapting anything is to very much not strip away immediately in all of what they are, but keep that essence bottled up within them. And I think what we did with Oh My Gods is keep what people know about Greek gods. Like Aphrodite is the god of love. And we try to make her this like really cute, bubbly girl who just wants everybody to love each other. But that also doesn't work out very well. But she's just trying so hard for people to like love each other. But also, and then Apollo, the god of music, he carries around a guitar mostly with him. And he's just this like really chill dude. Artemis, goddess of the hunt, she just is really good. She's like great at sports, but also she kind of is very protective of her brother, doesn't want anybody to get in the way of her relationship with her brother, but also she's just like super cool, but don't get in her way or she will hit you with an arrow, and like all of that stuff, you know, like it's, we just wanted them to feel so real, but then not take away that mythology element that like everybody knows and loves. And sometimes it's very hard, not gonna lie, because like we did have one of the characters that we had in there, and I think like she's in there for like maybe like 2.5 seconds, is Hera, and we wanted her in there, but we didn't want her to be attached to Zeus.
Right.
And we wanted her to be kind of not nice, but also just like a 2.5 second character that we can like be like Easter egg. So like what we did in with her is this kind of like make her this to distract her with like these other characters who are basically new and like nuisances and stuff like that. But it's just, and then like for all the other characters too, you kind of see that they have that that essence of who they are as Greek mythology figures, but just as kids.
Well, I think as well, it's always nice because I've been aware of Stephanie for quite a while because obviously she's an award-winning author and has built a real following with some of her other previous works before, sort of hooking up with yourself, Incha, as you've made your forays into the field as well. So it's
she's so brilliant and she's so clever and kind and oh god, can't say enough good things about Steph.
Well, yeah. The other great thing about the graphic novels as well is the wonderful artwork you've got with Juliana Moon. So did you, I mean, because obviously sometimes co-writing books can be quite difficult, and but mm-hmm. obviously you've clearly got a real synergy with Stephanie in the way that you work on different aspects of the book, and I've heard you speak about, you know, basically Stephanie, I'll leave the character development to you. So when it was coming to that, did you have Juliana in mind, or was that were you kind of looking for someone and you saw Juliana's work? Because Juliana's one of those remarkable people who basically just loved to draw and has ended up becoming an illustrator. She didn't go to college or university studying art. She's kind of developed through her own talent outside of the normal paradigms that you would expect people to come from in that illustration. So how did you find Juliana?
So funny enough, Stephanie was looking for an illustrator. And then when she came across Juliana's stuff, she like immediately like DM'd me and was just like, look at this, look at her profile, look at Juliana's profile, oh my God. And so like, we both like sat down with it and immediately I was just like, oh, her stuff is so cool though. Cause like she had this like small X-Men series that like, I'm like a big X-Men nerd. So when I saw that and then I saw how she took the, like the outfits of the X-Men, kind of like made them into figures that like we kind of did with the Greek gods and goddesses, where just made them into teenagers and made the outfits kind of just like mold in with them as actual people that like you and I would know. Yeah. I was just like, yo, we get email her now. Like, and we kind of got the ball like rolling almost immediately. Like Stephanie DM'd or emailed her, and then it was like lightning in a bottle with all three of us working together. It was just so, our synergy together was like so good, because like as Stephanie would like take charge of like, you know, the building of the story with me on the side, I would work with Juliana to build the characters with Stephanie on the side, but then have all of this stuff, and I literally would just tell Juliana, I am so sorry, I am about to send you link after link after document after link after link after playlist after playlist, and she's just like, send it all to me.
Yes. Well, as someone that shares a love of the X-Men, I mean, I was very fortunate when I first started reading them, Incha, because within about 2 years of reading it, we had the Phoenix Saga and then Days of Future Past, which when you're 11 years old, you just think are the greatest comics ever written, I think. So I was I was hooked from that point. But I appreciate what you say, because, you know, outfits in the 70s and 80s, and especially certain artists in the 90s. thank goodness we've moved to a more realistic portrayal of clothing, both for men and women.
Because
I tell you what, I don't know how, no wonder Cyclops had to wear a visor, because that outfit he used to wear did not look comfortable in the slightest, never mind anything else. Goodness. So it's something that it's one of those passions of mine that I have to kind of really leave alone, because I've got a ridiculous amount of comic in storage at my mum's because I simply don't have room for them on top of everything else that I've, which are the other hobbies I've picked up as I've grown in Chen and developed other addictions, some healthier than others as we've grown. So it's it is, but it's worked really well. Obviously, the first book was a great success. You've done a sequel.
Yeah.
Continuing the stories. Is that project ongoing?
Right now, we're kind of like on pause with it since like I'm doing a bunch of stuff. Stephanie's doing a bunch of stuff. Juliana's doing a bunch of stuff. So like we're all kind of just like right now, like pressing pause on it so that like we can all kind of just like do our own individual career stuff right now. But then like we always kind of like, I think in the back of all three of our minds, we're just like, I miss my kids. Like, those are our babies. And those are like all of our like kind of like big book first babies. Like, especially like with like me and Juliana, like Stephanie's had this incredible and still does have this like incredible career. So like me and Juliana are just like, we all created something so good.
Absolutely. It's one of those wonderful projects, I suppose. You can just decide when to bring the band back together and hit the road again.
Exactly. Just like, I don't, oh God, bad example. I was going to be like, we're like the Beatles of comics. Like, we just have to be apart for just like a little bit and we just come back together. Stronger than ever, making an Abbey Road. All like coming back with like mustaches. Like, we're here now. We got this.
Brilliant. Well, I hope it continues in the vein it started. I have to say, I saw a Q&A you guys had done a couple of years ago, and it was lovely seeing kids sending you questions, you know. And it was quite funny because there was a lot of them who were obviously using their parents' accounts, or they were getting their parents because the names weren't matching the questions. And they were saying, no, my name's such and such. But I think this is the thing, and obviously how you've ended up in this particular field. I'm always humbled and impressed by any author that encourages children to read and gets them to have that thirst, because for me, I think it's something I look back on as a child as an escape from normality. And I would imagine it doesn't matter where you're from or what your background is or whatever, wherever you are in the world, if you've got the ability to read a book, you will find something that you fall in love with and takes you away. As we were saying, it's similar to, you know, I'm very defensive when it comes to the value of comics for reading, because I categorically put my love of reading and my development as a very mature reader, as a young person, primarily through reading Marvel comics. 100%, mm-hmm. I was reading them faster than they could probably print them in those days. when I was like 5 or 6, I was devouring them. So yeah. By the time I was 10, I'd read Lord of the Rings. So, you know, I'd gone from Spider-Man at 6 to Tolkien at 10, because I'd just developed that love of fantasy and myth and magic and monsters that really, I just, in those days, we had 3 channels here. So there was very little on other than kids. And when you're watching Jason and the Argonauts and then there's kids cartoons on, you're like, well, I don't really want to watch that. That's, you know, I want to watch Jason and the Argonauts. I want to see a man fighting a skeleton again. I don't want to watch, you know. And that's not to say I don't love Tom and Jerry and Bugs Bunny and things like that. But it shows me, like I say, anybody that fires up kids of that age to get them into reading, I think is something. If you get them that young, it's something that will stay with them the rest of their lives, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I used to work as a... it's like a small personal story. I used to work as a library assistant. And when we started Oh My Gods, and even when I started doing Rosa Parks, I would see a couple of kids kind of just like, they want to read. They absolutely want to read, but like they couldn't find anything that really resonated with them that they would want to read. And I would kind of ask, I would always ask like, well, what do you watch on TV? Like, what's your favorite thing on TV? Or what kind of genre do you want to get into? Like, what have you read before that you really liked? And when they would tell me, it would always be one of those things where it's just like, well, I read this graphic novel that I really liked, or I read this comic that I really liked, or I really read this book that I really liked, but I can't remember the name of it, but it had like, it had a mouse in it and stuff like that. And I would be like, okay, give me 1 second. and then like, I know for a lot of the time when I was at my jobs, they would always, like, a lot of people around me, my old coworkers, would come to me for graphic novel questions, because I would always be like the person who can show a kid a graphic novel in a heartbeat, or convince a parent that graphic novels are books. Like, yes, they still are books. They're not going to not be books. They honestly command more attention from you.
Yes.
And I would always just take a kid like in the stacks and be like, okay, well, do you want, and then like, we would just like kind of pick and choose, and I would take my time with them, because that's what like you need for a kid to want to read. You gotta have their backs in a way to be like, if you want to read this, I want you to read this, and I want you to be happy with reading it. I used to have a kid that would come back all the time and would just like immediately track me down to be like, I read that, now I want to read Lumberjane part like 4, and I'd be like, okay, Gucci, I got you. But it's one of those, The best thing about being a library assistant, I think, was to be able to help a kid figure out what they wanted to read and convince parents that these, like, especially graphic novels, are worthwhile for a kid before they get into, like, those big-em books. And then those big-em books are really great for just having even like the fun ones. Just let them read whatever they want. If a kid comes in and he's like 13 years old and wants to read a picture book, who cares? Let them read it. They're reading it, and that's great. And I feel like we should all just be like so like happy that like kids want to read.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my previous roles many years ago, I worked for a charity in church, which was rehabilitating offenders back into the community. So this was people who had prison sentences or been on probation. And one of the things that really struck me was that a lot of them either couldn't read at all or not very well. And I remember trying to help these guys, because a lot of them, we had to try and improve their English and maths along with everything else to try and get them back into the normal world, as anybody wishes to churlishly consider it. And it was odd that I, as soon as they said that, I said, well, let's get some comics. And they were, oh, well, comics are for kids. And I said to a couple of the lads, I said, with the greatest respect, lads, kids can read these. You guys can't read. So we've got to start from somewhere. What do you like? Very similar to what you've just been saying. And that was the same kind of thing, finding out I'm into science fiction. So I thought, all right, I'll get some 2000 AD, get them some Judge Dredd, something that's a bit exciting that they can kind of get into, that makes them fires them up, that they want to know what's happening. And, you know, when you're speaking to people in their 20s and 30s who can't read, rather than just go, oh, well, outlines, you just think, well, let's go back to basics then.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And eventually it won them round. So because I used to do job clubs, and we'd have a big pile of old comics on the table for them. And the kids and the lads who just didn't want to do it, within 3 months, they were there. You'd see them. They'd be reading the comic. They'd go outside for a cigarette. They'd take the comic with them in the coffee. And so that alone, I was like, well, I've killed two birds with one stone. I'm educating them, but I'm also giving them the comic book. So,
yeah.
But it frustrates me, once again, as we were talking about horror earlier. We were at this point where the comic genre in the 80s had this massive sort of mature injection into it, where we got writers like Alan Moore and Miller sort of really doing gritty, hard-hitting work. That for me, that particular period, some of the best graphic novels ever written. I mean, I will defend The Watchmen all day, because that's one of those comics that even now, nearly 40 years on, I can't believe how powerfully well made that story is.
Yeah.
And so I find it incredible that people would dismiss this just because, as you say, it has to be pictures. There are some adults who consider themselves well-read who I think would struggle to comprehend The Watchmen, never mind a bunch of teenagers devouring it every month.
Yeah, no, exactly. Even when I was a kid, even the one comic that I have a symbol tattooed on me, I loved Batman. And Batman really got me into reading because I was really interested in not only him, but the psychology and the philosophy of him and the villains of Gotham. And I completely and utterly devoured it. But I do understand too, the frustration, and I've been absolutely frustrated myself with people just being well, comics are not viable. And it's here's the thing. I think comics are probably, and I've said this to other people where they're just I don't think that's true, but I'm just well, it's only in my opinion. But I think comics take up a lot more of your brain power than you really want it to be. First, you have to look at the panels going from the left to the right. Or if you're looking from manga, the right to the left. You talk about brain power and trying to connect all of those panels and those speech bubbles together. Let's go. But then you also have to do a little bit of context clues within the picture, within what you're actually reading. And I think comics are so underrated when it comes to having people develop the skills in order to read them. Because as we've said before, people just think that they're books with pictures in them, but people, we write them, we illustrate them, we color them, we ink them, we have to we do all of this work for comics and trying to make it a thing where people can actually sit there and be oh, I got you, this is amazing. But I think it's also just a book, a thing that's just is dismissed, which is such a shame, because again, takes up a lot more of your brain power to read a graphic novel or a comic than it does with anything else. And I will defend that to my dying breath.
Well, as somebody that's been reading them for the best part of 40 odd years, Insha, the one thing I always smile about is that the amount of times I've heard that comic books are dying, especially sort of in the noughties, after that brief hurrah, because there always seems to be this thing. Right now, I think it's the most popular comics have been for 30 odd years across all genres, which I think is obviously a direct tie into a lot of films that have been very successful as well over the last 10 or 15 years. But once again, that's had the effect that it's made people want to read more. So
exactly.
15 years ago, people saying, oh, yeah, comics are dead, when Marvel's doing the Civil War and DC were doing their things about Infinite Worlds and everything was going off, and people saying, oh, this is the last hurrah, that's it. Where will we be? There'll be no such thing as comics in 10 years, or it'll all be digital, whatever. And I think what one of the strange things about the pandemic, and it's happened with books as well, is that sales the first year dropped, and then they just rebounded massively to a level before the pandemic, I think in 21-22, that figures for things that people were considering a dying art form suddenly rebounded to the highest they'd been in the best part of 30 years, which is a remarkable thing.
It's wild. It's honestly, seeing the comic sales, especially when I was at the library during the pandemic, but seeing the want and demand for how many graphic novels that went out and how many comics that went out, I was floored by it. And I don't think it's really slowed down at all. And especially because how you said, when we have the movies and everything that goes along with that, it just makes you want to go okay, what is this storyline? I want to know more about this storyline. And like, especially like seeing like something like Wanda and Vision, and then all of a sudden you go to like the No Mutants storyline of the, oh god, House of M.
Yes.
And you just want to know more about that. I remember also seeing, this is kind of going like back into like books, but when Star Wars kind of reinvented itself, and then like all of the shows came out of that, like The Mandalorian and Obi-Wan and stuff like that, there was a massive popularity at the library for Star Wars books because no one had ever really thought to dive into Star Wars books like that and be like, there's some great lore in those Star Wars books that I think people should absolutely read. And it's surprising every single time, like, how much you say, like, Sam Mag's book, the one that she just released recently, it has a lot of great Star Wars lore in it, and it has a lot of great Star Wars moments in it, and it's an incredible book. And I feel like the Star Wars just line of books are very much taken for granted. But I feel like we should just like all be like, if you are looking at a movie, a television show, or anything like that, and you want to learn more, pick up that comic, pick up that book, pick up anything. It'll tell you way more than you need to know. And it also will like just bring you into something that you really are going to be surprised at. And then after that, if you find something adjacent to that, okay. Yeah. Like, everybody wins.
yeah, absolutely. It's always a bonus as well for most of my friends, because they know that I'm a comic geek. So the fact that they've all had children who've grown up over the last 15 years, Incha, who have become obsessed with superheroes in that time, means that their parents don't have to have conversations with them anymore. They just invite Uncle Paul round, give him a couple of give him a couple of glasses of wine, and he'll tell them all about Secret Wars. So, you know, it works for everybody. The people that used to think, why have you got that hobby 20 years ago, now think, thank God he's got that hobby, because he can talk to my children. I have no idea who the Falcon is. What does this mean? Who's the Winter Soldier? You know, why have there been three Robins? Who's Nightwing? So you have to explain all these things to their children. And it's great. You get free wine and the children go away happy.
I get that sometimes too when like it comes to like some horror movies. They'll just be like, I don't know, ask Incha. And then all of a sudden I'm just like, you want me to explain Demons 1 and 2? Let's go. Produced by Dario Argento. And then I'm just like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, good luck explaining them. Blimey. Goodness me. I remember, because I've got a friend, you know, I was touching back on horror films. Mentioning demons is making me, my face is aching through smiling, isn't it? Because my God, I've seen some batshit films in my time watching horror films. But good God, demon, because I've got Shudder. So one of the favourite things, I think it's worth having a subscription to Shudder purely for the In Search of Darkness documentaries. Yeah. Because, oh, I just love them. And when demons turned up, I was like, oh, here we go with the nails coming off and the teeth falling out. And what's going on here? Why is there a helicopter? What is happening here? So, you know, it's just balmy. And I love those kind of crazy balmy 80s films that we have where everybody's like going mad. It's like Suspiria.
Oh, my God.
And the original. And it's one of those things that I didn't realize it at the time, but when I rewatched both of them, because I think the reboot they did fairly recently was bloody good, actually, I have to say, as reboots
yes.
go.
Yeah.
Which doesn't happen that often. And when I watched it again, sort of a couple of years ago, I was like, why has this ballet school got a room full of barbed wire? What the hell is going on here? I've never realised it. I'm thinking, how's she fallen into a room full of barbed wire? What kind of ballet school is this?
It's so funny to like, Suspiria is like one of my favourite movies. I think it, like, the original is one of my favorite movies. I think the remake is so wonderful. It's so good. It carries an incredibly different tone to it, like, where we got that giallo Suspiria from Dario, and then from I believe it's from Luca, then we got this like gritty dark Berlin that's like, it's like, man, two different vibes but also the same vibe. That whole Mother Suspirium trilogy knocks me out completely. I love Dario Argento. I think he's like one of the best filmmakers that I had ever picked up in my 20s. I have seen, oh my God, what is it? I've seen Suspiria so many times, but I'm blanking on the name right now, but it's, do you like know the one with like the doll, and the doll is just like hightailing it to the dude?
I'm
blanking on that name so badly, but that movie, I've seen that movie tons of times too, and it's all from, like, I've seen them all on Shudder, and how you said, I think having a subscription to Shudder for a horror fan is probably like the best. Another subscription that's like very great is an Arrow Video subscription. Yo, if you ever just need to sit down and watch some like wild 70s, 80s movies,
that's the place to go.
All there.
Very much so. Well, keeping with the horrific tone, let's get to this wonderful new book of yours, Hanging with Vampires. And I have to say, one of the things I've learned from reading this book is that, once again, Incha, you've mentioned something I didn't ever sort of comprehend or think of before, and that is the use of garlic bread in a vampire hunter's kit. And I think this is an important step for us, because it is one of those things. And I do love the fact that you've got a garlic. I mean, this is, you know, you've got a recipe for garlic bread. You've got a guide on decomposing. It is a book that, yes, we're talking about books aimed at a young adult audience. But I have to say, as I said to you before we started the interview, it really made me laugh in a good way. It made me chuckle. It was funny. It was well researched. It's well written. It's beautifully illustrated by, is it Lilia Bletz?
Yes.
Fabulous illustrations. I love the way it's set. There's some gorgeous little pages in there just of bats and fangs and things that are just really cool and striking. I suppose the first question I have really in regards to this, obviously this is the first of hopefully a long series in regards to these supernatural creatures that are out there. Did you want to do vampires first because you wanted to get back at your aunt about stopping you watching Dracula, or was this something that you wanted to just do vampires, or was this a publishing thing that they said, right, we want to do this but we want to do vampires first?
So it was the third. It was I wish I had honestly, if it was like me just getting back at my aunt, I would the revenge in me, so sweet. But but I was just like, well, I guess I write about vampires now, so who won this battle? But it was like the third thing. So Quark Books kind of like reached out and was just like, hey, we know Insha loves like everything horror and supernatural. She want to write a book? And I'm like, absolutely I do. So me and my editor, shout out to her, she's amazing, just one of the best editors I've ever had. Every single time I came to her with something, because she gave me like a big outline, but then like every time I came to her with something and I was just like, oh my God, did you know that this was a thing? And she was just like, what? And I'm just like, as I'm researching, I'm just so excited because I'm just like, did you know that like when a body decomposes, this happened? And she's just like, no. But yeah, it was the third thing. Yeah, they just reached out and was just like, vampires would go first, and then we'll figure it out from there, which was incredible because like, I had already had a love for vampires, obviously, from like a really young age. But then like to actually be able to like sit down, research, and then have this like cool company behind you to be like, hey, you got this. I'm like, uh-huh, I'm pretty sorry to everything that I will ever do.
I suppose then as well, Incha, the difficulty when you've got a blank canvas like that is because there is so much you can pull in from vampiric lore from around the world. I suppose you have to, as well as the fact that the audience that you're aiming it at, I suppose, once again, the biggest difficulty here is what do you strip away to leave and focus on rather than, because you could dive into, you could probably write a full book just focusing on vampires in film and television, really,
yeah.
Or vampires in books or vampires from certain areas. You could literally just do a book on a particular, such is the richness of the field. So I suppose that's the biggest challenge, despite, you know, very similar to me, that having a love of the subject, that's the hardest thing is what to keep out, really.
Yeah, because every time I went to my editor and I was just like, can we put this in? And then it was always kind of like, I think we may need to cut that. And it would always be, and the one hardest challenge I know for me in general, and this is because, like, I swear this is me as a person, but and I'm not like, rah, but I love gory things, and I'm always down to talk about gore in horror and in books and stuff like that. I'm just always down. And the one thing that I realized that, like, I myself, in getting the outline and stuff like that, I just needed to pull back my love for gore, because I can also just like make an entire book of just like, well, when a vampire bites you, then like all of a sudden inside your bloodstream goes like this, and then I was just like, wait, gotta pull back. And then also like not doing those like sensual or sexuality themes with them too, just like Dracula's whole deal into becoming like, and the succubus angle of it, the incubus yes. angle of it and stuff like that. We needed to not do that for this particular age range, because like I think that's a whole other book too, of how sensuality and sexuality in vampire movies and myths and lore and legend really have come back into our age. But again, for this audience, can't do that. So it was very hard to just kind of like have all the knowledge that I knew about vampires, have what my editor really like set me and what we both wanted to do, and then be like, I can't get too excited about the gore because I know that we can't put all the gore in. I can't get too excited about this because, like, I know I can't, I don't have enough room for that. So I think with the book writing, like the book itself is just a perfect, perfect, perfect streamline of the gore that I needed to put in there to talk to kids about, because like decomposition is like an actual thing that we do need to talk about.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the Middle Ages and the vampire panic, that's another big gory thing that I was like, yes, let me have this. And even like the vampire, there's a little section in there like on vampire deaths that I was just like, yes, slip it in. So like those like fun things that we got to do. But then it's just like it was a really, really bonkers balancing act between what we can put, what we can't put. But the book is just such a great combination of what we just know about vampires and what I love about vampires and what I hope kids will love about vampires and adults will love about vampires. Everybody will love about vampires. But just a really hard balance.
Well, I always judge any book about vampires primarily on one thing, Incha. And that is if you mention my favourite vampire, which is, of course, the Zhangxi from China. Because I adore the Chinese vampire films. Primarily, I will say that Mr. Vampire is easily one of my favourite films ever made. It's one of the greatest kung fu vampire films ever, and that is such a genre. It's not a big one, but there's plenty of them. So I'm always surprised whenever I hear people or I read certain things about vampires or books about vampires where they focus primarily on European and North American things, as you say about the vampire panic, the New England one famously, and other such cases in Wisconsin and Wyoming and places like that where you had these strange little vampire flaps. So for me, when I see a book, even though it's aimed at a younger audience, I think often books that are aimed at adults can try and be a bit more open-minded. As daft as that sounds about a subject as rich and as varied as vampires, that a lot of people just don't bother with them. And like I say, I think they're fabulous. Anything that hops towards you to kill you is scary in my book.
Yes. That's the one thing that I absolutely loved about that chapter is I'm taking people all over the world to just see what kind of like vampires that there are in different cultures and countries. But it took me on a journey too. I had never heard of that vampire. I had never heard of most of the vampires that like I actually like have. So I was like, yo, have we just been like neglecting all of these really cool vampires that like are in different cultures and they have like such rich lore. Like I remember like giving the draft to my editor and I had like paragraphs about all of the different vampires because I was just like, I think that like I don't know why, but it's just that chapter itself really, really, really made me step out of my comfort zone and really made me step out of anything I knew about vampires. And that's, I think, when it also hit me that vampires from different cultures, from different parts of the world, they all combine into what we know now. Mm. And even if the history is lost, like, I'm really happy that we got to actually put them in. But even if the history is lost, like, there is just this fundamental thing about vampires that just carries across, like, a bunch of places. Mm. And I'm gonna like be emotional, but like it made me like tear up a little bit to know that like I could write about like these cool vampires with the help of my editor and even with the help of our illustrator that like we had the opportunity to bring these to life for people because like nobody would know what a Zhangxi is until like we were just like, let's do it. Like, let's just write about them. Let's bring them to the forefront. And yeah, I'm going to stop before I get emotional.
Well, I think what we've discovered there is that there is a whole world of wonderful Chinese horror films you've never seen then, because there are 5 Mr. Vampire Chinese films.
No way.
I believe that they've recently all been remastered. Because I had a really bad I think it might have been a US import DVD that was about 20 years old and shit, and it was on its last legs. And then during one of the highlights of the pandemic was discovering that they'd remastered and re-released it on Blu-ray about 2 years ago, and it looks beautiful and it's a wonderful film. The rest of the series has just been collected and is being released next month as a box set. So then I will have all of them on Blu-ray or remastered. So I would, if you've never seen any of them, obviously start with the original Mr. Vampire and just sit back and enjoy an hour and 45 minutes that will teach you everything you need to know about Chinese vampires and the weird things about them, as well as a really weird subplot involving a sexy ghost.
Oh my god. Let's go. Oh, that's going to be my entire weekend. That's my entire weekend. I got it now.
Hey, I'm just here to help and spread the word about the Jiangxi. I suppose as well. I mean, it's always nice as well. Obviously, as someone with a love of horror, as we've mentioned for both of us, it's nice when you see books that don't steer away from certain films as well, because once again, you have this hierarchy, even in genres, Insha, where certain films will be dismissed or not counted. So I'm always happy to see Fright Night get mentioned more than once. because it's a wonderful film. It's one of my favourite sort of horror comedy films of the 80s. Vamp as well, which is a very odd film. But also the criminally, and it still amazes me how criminally underrated it is. It's one of those films that you say to people, have you seen it? And they'll go, oh no. And then they watch it and they go, oh my God, how have I never heard of this film? Near Dark.
Oh my God. One of my wants in that chapter was to list every single underrated horror film of vampire origin that I can get my hands on. And Near Dark is one that's super near and dear to me. It's actually like one of the first films besides Dracula and Nosferatu that made me fall in love with vampires. Because I had never seen a vampire Western just on the road movie. And I was just like, this is incredible. Mm. This is bizarre. I love this. Like Bill Paxton,
yeah,
covered in blood.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
all I could need. Thank you very much. But even the other films that we mentioned too, like A Girl Walks Home Alone, yes, at Night. I specifically was just like, we cannot take that out, because that movie is also very near and dear to my heart. Because I have never, I never, Western vampires, I think, are my favorite thing now. And that movie showed a different side of vampirism that I had ever seen. And also, it's made by a woman of color who... It's incredible that movie is so underrated, and it feels like nobody has seen it, and I think more people should. The blaxploitation vampire movie Ganga and Hess.
Yes.
Ganja and Hess, sorry. I think more people should see that. And but in that chapter specific, and Dracula AD 1972.
Yeah, that's a crazy
film. More people should
film.
See that. I wanted to just involve as many vampire movies as you can get, and just have them be this. If you're starting a vampire film club, this is what you start with.
Yeah.
And then work your way up from there or down from there. It doesn't even matter. Hmm. But yeah, I'm super proud of that chapter.
Good. Good, yeah. Dracula AD 1972. Dracula Eats Hippies is one of my favourite from the Hammers, because it's one of the ones towards the end as well. So there's some interesting parts to that. It's and it's got a hell of a soundtrack. Goodness.
So good. Oh my god.
I mean, the other thing as well, going on this, then I'm going to give you another recommendation. Insha, in regards to Chinese vampires, have you ever seen Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires?
I've seen the trailer for it, and I feel like I have it somewhere nuzzled in my letterbox to see it. Yeah. So is that I need to immediately.
Absolutely. It's one of those films that when I first saw it, I thought, oh, this isn't very good. Now I think it's fab. I love it. It's brilliant, because it's a real strange film. And there are two very strange stories about that particular film. One is they showed Christopher Lee the script and he went, I'm not doing this shit, is what he said. And then
king status.
The actor who plays Dracula in it, who they had to get in to replace him, filmed it all, brilliant, went to the premiere, sat down, started watching it, he came on, and then he suddenly thought, that's not my voice, and they'd redubbed him and never told him. So he was watching himself talk, and it was a different, completely different voice that came out of the character, and he was apoplectic. He was livid.
Oh my god.
Yeah. It was supposed to be the start of a series, but then Hammer really sort of hit the buffers, and I think within 2 or 3 years they're gone, sadly. But so yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it is really good actually, because it is essentially a vampire, another sort of kung fu vampire film with Peter Cushing in it.
Oh my god, Peter, under the most, like, the coolest vampire movies I've ever seen have Peter Cushing in them, obviously, as Van Helsing, and Christopher Lee as Dracula. And I have to watch more, because my friend recently got me into, like, watching, like, a slew of the Hammer horror films, because, like, in my filmology, I feel like I missed that weird part of it, and I'm just like, I love these. like, Christopher Lee knows where he is.
Yeah, absolutely. No, there's some belters. We had a Hammer horror weekend here. We've got, like, a local independent cinema. It's like a Art Deco cinema that does occasional special showings, and they did a Hammer one last year. The Devil Rides Out, which was brilliant to see them in a cinema, and they'd even got some really old, like, 1970s adverts in between, like, for martini and things, with people skiing and going, oh, well, let's have a martini and ski, because that's not going to end in tears. You know, those kind of things. People drinking champagne as they drive a speedboat really quickly, that kind of advert. And but it was just fabulous, and they'd got all... There was a guy there who was a collector, and he collected all the original Hammer posters from cinemas in the 60s and 70s, and he got, like, lobby cards, his own personal collection, so there was, like, a little bit of memorabilia there as well. And I just forgot that there are so many films like that from that era that you just miss out on it sometimes. I used to be the same with sort of 70s horror, a lot of it sort of later 70s stuff, up until you got to Halloween and Friday the 13th and shit. I think you get these blind spots where you get to a point where you don't go back to a certain era for whatever. You think, oh, I've seen everything. And then when you find out you haven't, you end up discovering some real gems.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm starting to do that now, obviously, with, like, Hammer horror films. But I'm also doing that with, like, 80s films now. Like, especially a lot of 80s horror that's Death Spa.
Yes.
And I was like, I don't know what this is. But I think it might be in my top 200, because what is this? Who made this? Why did they? But I love this. And a lot of other Giallo films that I also miss too, that I'm kind of trying to go back on. Like, I love the filling in the spots of, like, movie knowledge that, like, I don't have. And it's also, like, the same thing with like, when we were writing the book, it was kind of just, like, filling in the spots of vampire knowledge that, like, I have never been privy to. So it's, like, nice that, like, now it's in my head. And at parties, I'm like, did you know that the vampire panic of, like, 17... And then they're just like, nope, nope. I'm great at parties.
Yeah, no, trust me. I'm usually sat in the corner waiting for somebody to mention Bigfoot. So, not really. I'll go and tell people about Bigfoot. But so
I'll do the same. I get you.
Good. So, obviously, as we were saying, this is going to be the first of a long series, I hope. So you've already got the second one in the pipeline, which has got the wonderful title of Chilling with Ghosts. So I would expect more of this wonderful mixture of humour and information and recipes, Incha, that we can expect. I'm not sure how you're going to follow up composting in this one, but I look forward to seeing what else you can bring up. So how's this one been going? Have you got it done? Is it just going through the final stages of proofreading, or is it sort of ready to go and you're itching to get onto the next strange subject?
Oh my god. So Chilling of a Ghost is like super done. I'm waiting for it to be in my hands, because Chilling with Ghosts is, it's funny, but it also gave me like a little tiny small existential crisis. just a wee bit. There's a lot of like really, really tough subjects in Chilling with Ghosts, because obviously like ghosts were once human and now they're like deceased. So it's a little bit more of a more sensitive subject matter book, but it's still so good. I remember when I started writing it, I went back to my editor and I asked her if I can add in a chapter. You'll probably once you get the book, you'll see the chapter and you'll be like, oh, she's talking about that one. Because I felt like I needed to explain it, and I'm very good at talking about it, but I feel like if we were going to move on out of the first chapter and into the rest of the book, I needed them to understand this particular subject that a lot of people now are very accepting of, but at the same exact time, because of the fact that we're dealing with people who have passed on, we really need to talk about it. And the subject matter, spoilers, is death. But the Chilling with Ghosts, I love hanging with vampires, but like Chilling with Ghosts, I think it hits close, but it is still funny. It'll give you this sense of just like, yo, I could be a ghost hunter, let's go. And like that's the feeling that like I want to bring or I want everybody to have when going into Chilling with Ghosts, because like with hanging with vampires, it's just like, oh, I can see a vampire from a mile away now because I got like this guidebook and intro by my side. But now I'm just like, yo, if you want to get your e-meters out, go forth and find a ghost, I got you.
Well, I think it's a very important point that you raise there. And I think especially when you're dealing with the audience that you are, it is one of those things that I think for adults or maturer readers, perhaps, there is this presumption that everybody knows what ghosts are and where they're supposed to have come from in Shire. And I think you have to really, as you say there, it's a wonderful idea to not ignore it, because I would imagine the vast majority of books that deal with ghosts, they either do it in a humorous way or they just don't mention death at all.
Yeah.
And I think one of the crucial parts of writing for a younger audience is addressing the issues around grief and loss and death in a way that doesn't frighten them and explains it in a balanced manner, and also allows them to understand what the subject really is, because I think it gets so overlooked that there just doesn't seem to be any emphasis on that kind of aspect for it. And I would imagine that the thing we often don't comprehend or forget, for a lot of people, when you're 9, 10, 11 years old, you probably don't understand what grief or loss is. You've probably never lost a loved one, a friend, a pet. You're at a young age. You know, within about 10 years, your pets have probably lived as long as you have. You probably know your grandparents. Anybody that may have passed on is usually great-grandparents or something like that. So you're not immune to it, but you've probably not been exposed to it in a normal family setting. So if you go into a book and go, right, ghosts are the spirits of your dead relatives, that's what happens to you when you die, then you're going to have sleepless nights at 9 years old. No shadow of a doubt. Exactly. Unless you're the 9-year-olds we were, isn't you?
Exactly. exactly. Like that was a really important part about Ghost, especially in those beginning chapters where we were kind of just like, we want them to understand that ghosts come from everywhere. Ghosts come from the past. If you're, oh my God, was it Charles Dickens? They come from the future, unfortunately. Yes. And I mean, ghosts come from your loved ones, other people's loved ones, anybody, like your pets, anybody. So we just wanted to have kids understand what death means in the realm of what this book will call for them to continue to read. And then also how you said, like, the overall understanding of just what death in general means. And it's, I think, I will speak for myself and maybe my editor, since she wanted to like actually like put it out into the world. I think I do it with an understanding and a personal understanding about how death works for me as a kid. And how death worked for me now, because while I was writing Chilling with Ghosts, my godfather, who like my dad is my dad's best friend, so he passed away. And I had to deal with death in a way that I had never felt before as an adult. But then it made me feel like a kid again, where I was losing somebody that I loved, and I didn't know how to properly like where I should place those emotions. And then dealing with the grief and the loss, and then also dealing with my dad's grief and loss. Yeah. It's kind of just like one of those, I want to write this from a perspective of if I was a kid and I needed to tell my, like if me as an adult needed to tell my kid self what this meant. And that made it so much easier to write. And I swear to you, it's like this small paragraph where I'm just like explaining what it means, but by that point I think it meant so much to me as a person. And then I think that if a kid is going through this, or a kid doesn't have a proper understanding of it, and like adults like kind of just are just like, don't want to know, I don't know what to say, I think that will help a little bit. And then we also do have like this really cool list of like, if you're dealing with that, here are some things that you can do, and here are some things that you can read and stuff like that, so like help. But it's, but that entire book is as fun and as wonderful and as funny as it is. It has a lot of like sensitive things that like really, really will hit home, but at the same exact time will still make a kid feel like, again, I could be a ghost hunter, bro. Let's go.
Well, I can't wait to read that one after reading this one. I never thought I'd be put myself in the box of being a fan of young adult fiction, Incha, but you've won me with your wonderful work, both previously and with this wonderful series about the supernatural. So I shall let you return to the light, as it were, and let you leave us for today. So where can everybody follow your work, find you online, and get a hold of a copy of your wonderful books? Even, and I would say this without the smallest sense of irony, even as an adult who loves monsters and vampires, I recommend anybody buys this book, even if it's for your kids or yourself, or you're just really interested, because like I say it's funny, it's beautifully illustrated, it made me laugh, it's got little nuggets in it that books for adults will sometimes overlook or miss, so I recommend it highly. So where can they track you down, my love?
So on Instagram, I'm Inchagram with two
I's. Awesome.
And then on Twitter, that I don't use that much, so if you're gonna like sincerely track me down, I'm on Instagram. But on Twitter, I'm Night of the Living Fits, or Night of the Fits, I believe. I think it's Night of the Fits. Do not quote me on this. Just like chat, just type in Incha on Twitter. And I also, my website is ifitzpatrick.com. You can find a link to the books on there, or if you're interested only in Hanging with Vampires, I completely understand. You can go to Quark Books or wherever books, like wherever your books are sold, you can probably track it down there, or ask your local librarian if they can get you a copy. Always use your local library. And for Oh My Gods and Oh My Gods 2, same places. You can track it down anywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, thriftbooks.com. I'm not judging you where you get your books. Thank you for reading them. And even Rosa Parks 2. You can find that there anywhere too. And yeah, I think that's where I hide in my corners of the internet.
Lovely. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for everybody to track you down. And also, as you touched on there, your wonderful book in regards to Rosa Parks, which was part of the whole series of historical incidents that have been written and illustrated for a young adult audience to introduce them to challenging subjects. And I would imagine that was a real feather in your cap to be asked to contribute to such an important tome, even at this day and age.
I honestly still can't. That was my first major work as a person by myself. And I was just like, they want me to write about who? But then after a while I got the opportunity also. I think it's coming out in early September. But also I got to write about Tituba from the Salem Witch Trials too.
Wow.
So that's in a thought Rosa Parks was wow. Salem Witch Trial. Whole of the ball game. Yeah.
Is that part of the same series, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow.
So it's who was first, I think it's who was accused in the Salem Witch Trials, Tituba. Oh. And that is drawn by the wonderful Rowan McCall. A brilliant, my God, illustrations are bonkers. But that's coming out in September. Again, don't quote me on that, but you can find a link for it on my website and on penguinrandomhouse.com. But yeah.
Brilliant.
Again, the luck that I've had in writing for like all these people, I'm like, thank you. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I think talent's got more to do with it than luck, isn't she?
I'm like scrunching my head. I'm so sorry to everyone I've ever known.
Don't do yourself down, you're fine. Incha, it's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to speak with you. Thank you for your time today. I wish you the very best and hopefully we'll speak again in the future.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.